for another conversation. Today we have two guests, Professor Andrea Fabrizio and Professor Gregory Marks, both of the Hostos Community College in Bronx, New York. This month in First Things, I did a little piece profiling a Great Books program in Monterey Peninsula College, talking to the students at these two-year colleges, many of whom were not star students in high school, but are reading in these programs Plato and Aristotle and Frederick Douglass and other classic works. And then I know that there is a similar program, slightly different, we'll get into that, at Hostos Community College, and so we invited them in to come and talk with us. Tell us first, welcome, both of you.
Thanks very much for having us.
What is the program?
So our program is a collaboration with Columbia University, and the goal of it is to bring elements of the Columbia Core into the Hostos Community College curriculum. So what we've done is we have two courses, English 110, which is expository writing, and English 111, Lit and Comp, that all students coming into Hostos must take. So our program is a faculty development initiative where faculty voluntarily participate in our grant to think about ways of incorporating these texts from the Columbia Core into our composition sequence.
Yeah, and so I think that's one unique element of it is that it's a pre-existing class, English 110 and 111. Basically, almost all American students have to take a writing class. And so instead of setting up a separate Great Books program, which is just the logistics of it are very difficult, getting through the Senate, getting through curriculum committees, instead working with Roosevelt Montas over at Columbia University, we'd had a series of discussions where we decided to kind of embed the Great Books rather than in a huge separate program. We decided to embed them into these pre-existing classes, and it's so far it's worked out pretty well.
That sounds like an interesting model. Because I think a lot of people would like to have more courses in their schools that do have a lot of the classics, even in freshman composition programs, but they worry about how do I create a program? How do I get money for this program? How do I get office
right.
space? How do I work with a faculty curriculum committee? What is this going to do with the general ed requirements? And of course,
right.
there's always the turf issue, right?
Right.
People are always worried, what does this mean for me?
Right.
And by doing this, you're not taking any money away from anyone. You're not taking any resources away from any other part of the campus. You're really just presenting something to teachers who've been there already. They're already teaching
right.
the course.
Exactly.
And you're giving them maybe some resources, some professional development to try to integrate these kinds of materials into teaching students where to put their commas.
Exactly. And so we always have to remind ourselves that it's not less a content-based course than it is. We have to remind ourselves it's a writing class that's really supposed to develop the reading and writing skills of these students. And we're in the South Bronx, and so it's sometimes a challenging demographic. That is, some of them have really...
Who are the students?
Well,
they're from everywhere.
And now, when I first got there about 10 years ago, oftentimes you'd have, I would say probably about a third of the students were traditional community college students. That is, they were kind of older men and women who were interested in kind of career development, maybe needed a little degree or a little certificate and a certain number of hours in order to get a pay jump or something like that. Now we're getting students directly out of high school and a lot of immigrants. The school was founded in 68 and then opened in 70 in response to the Latino population of the South Bronx, Puerto Ricans, and now many more Dominicans, I think, to really serve their interest. But now, I mean, my gosh, last semester you said you had a group of students with literally 10 different languages?
Mm-hmm.
Eastern European, Ghana, West Africa, South Africa, Asia.
And that's one of the things that's so nice about the program. One of the things I think we've really enjoyed is that you have students in our classes who come from such diverse backgrounds, culturally, ethnically, in terms of their skills and preparedness for college too. And then the books that we've tried to select from the enormous Columbia Core curriculum, we only have four books in each class that we're working on, deal with themes that really tie people together. So even though you have this range of differences in your classroom, a question, what is knowledge? What is love? You know, what is it to know yourself? Those are questions that everybody asks themselves. So that becomes a theme in the room that everybody can be part of a conversation, everybody can bring something to the table. So it's a unifying sort of thematic experience.
And to enroll in Hostos, you need your high school diploma,
mm-hmm.
and you need to pass a test.
Well, it's an open, in theory, it's an open admissions campus. However, you do have to, there are some placement tests to whether or not you should be in a development. But in fall 16, 83% of our students, incoming students, failed one of the tests. Reading, writing, arithmetic. Of course, it's mostly math, you know.
Right,
the
right,
poor
right.
students who don't know their algebra and so have to take a remedial math course.
Now, this student population, you are hitting with Plato. Mm-hmm. How does that go?
I the first day of class, because Plato is, The Trial and Death of Socrates is the first text we teach in the English 110 curriculum. So I distinctly remember last semester teaching it and one student saying, you know, Professor, I don't understand this. Why are we reading this? Can't we read something more interesting? And then as we work through it, because one of the things we really try to work on with the curriculum is to pace it and to make it accessible, make it relevant. Mm-hmm. So we didn't just spend one class period on the trial and death of Socrates. I think we spent like 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. And then mm-hmm. as the semester progressed, as we went through the text, by the end of it, she said, you know, this made me think about things I never thought about before. So I think that the beginning of the semester, there's often a little bit of resistance, a bit of pushback of why am I reading this? How does this connect to me? But because we really try to pick texts that have these themes, you know, about what it is to be a human being, I think the students, you know, they appreciate being part of that conversation as the semester
and
goes
think,
on.
I think also Plato is a good one to start with, actually, because it's a dialogic form, and so you have people chatting, and so in the youth of Rhodes, they're chatting about, hey, you know, you're going to trial? Why are you going to trial? Why would you do something like that against your father? And so it has to do with family relationships, has to do with the theme of justice, and also just it kind of ends in frustration. And so that's a very kind of human thing of having 10 pages of talk, and you don't really get anywhere. And so the students understand that. And then with Trial and Death, with Apology, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, just so many quotable quotes that do just, no matter... That's a wonderful thing about the diversity of it. You can't really, they're so diverse that you can't really target students. Okay, I'm targeting this culture because I know that's really relevant to them. It has to just be this human discussion. And so, you know, I know that I don't know, so that puts me up on you because I'm humble, you know, or, you know, I really got to examine my life because that's what humans got to do. You know, am I going to really drink the poison? Really? Is there a better life after this one? So all of those students are, they're pretty responsive, you know.
Mm-hmm. I imagine if you slow down, you take it, you know, when I teach sometimes, I'll teach something like this is to Emory University students, pretty competitive university.
Yeah.
I have to go very slowly through something like the critique of judgment.
Yes, absolutely.
Critique of judgment.
Right.
And we'll spend 2 weeks going over 10 pages.
Yes.
Because so much of that is so conceptually dense. But also, there's the reading training factor. Right? Slow down.
Right.
These aren't text messages that if you can't process them very quickly, that's a bad thing.
Right.
No. You have to develop this reading posture in which you go through that sentence and you might mark out specific words.
Right.
A metaphor might strike you, an image.
Right.
And you ponder that. And so I see no problem with having some of these difficult texts. You said you do Hamlet mm-hmm. also. How much time can you spend?
That was a tough...
with Hamlet, but you should be able to translate Hamlet's plight into...
Correct.
...a relevant situation for them. I got a problem here, and I'm not quite sure what to do about
right.
it.
Right.
We did a fun exercise with Hamlet, because this is the first semester we've taught Hamlet. We introduced it into the curriculum this term, and in trying to explain a soliloquy, right, of what that is, I had asked my class, I said, do we have any sort of modern equivalent of telling the world how you feel without telling the actual person that you're feeling it about what you feel, and they're like, "Oh yeah, Facebook." One of the writing assignments, because we always have to keep in mind our goal is the reading and the writing. One of the kind of informal writing assignments was to have the class in small groups translate the soliloquy into a Facebook post.
Into Facebook, that's a good exercise. In when I teach writing classes, sometimes I will have students write a paper in a particular idiom that's awful, right? Yeah. I want you to do a terrible discourse.
Yeah.
You can do adolescent slang or something like that, just low diction. And then let's translate that into super high, ridiculously Latinate diction.
Right.
And I think that's a wonderful exercise, not just for the relevance factor to make it real for them, but also to get them to begin to understand different registers of diction and language, and get a little more flexibility in how you understand your own words.
Yeah, exactly. And our students they come in and they, and as one of my colleagues said, this group of students really believes in the American dream. And so, they've left a country because they had dissatisfactions with that country, and they came to America, and they're really interested in engaging things like that. And so,
On that American dream issue, you hear a lot of resistance against these kinds of classics, right? They're too Eurocentric. They're pro-Western. They're not diverse enough. You just don't get any of that. Is that over? Are we past that kind of hesitation about the classics, great books, whatever we want to call them?
I think one of the things we wanted to give our students the opportunity to do, it's if you want to reject them in whatever way, but before you can reject something, you have to know it. And I think for many of our students, I know in my classes, it's the first time they read Oedipus. It's the first time they've heard of the Inferno. It's the first time they read The Trial and Death of Socrates. So we don't want to reject it for them. To present it to them, to make them part of texts and conversations that have shaped the society in which they live.
They really didn't get this in their high school training.
And also, just especially in English 110, we do nonfiction. In English 111, which is the second half of our sequence of the freshman composition sequence, we do literature. But especially in the nonfiction, you see, they're just seeing that the tradition is always about rejecting and accepting and savage criticism. Just, you can't read Frederick Douglass's, what the 4th of July means to the Negro. You can't read that without just being, my God, this man is just savaging, our founders, justifiably so. Mary Wollstonecraft just saying, we have to resist tyranny, whether it happens in the, with the head of my house or with the king's tyranny. We have to resist this. And so this conversation is not about having a stable, coherent body of a canon which can't be touched. It's a conversation about kind of being a spectacle to this constant self-criticism which West and maybe the whole human condition is about.
And to make them a part of that conversation. That's empowering, to know that conversation and to become a participant.
Sometimes to really sell it, we say, the people over there, 2 miles away at Columbia University, they get it too. And you're reading the
Our
same.
Students don't deserve this.
Exactly.
They deserve the best.
Exactly, precisely. And so that sells.
And so the students come into class without any real partisan cultural sense of things, and they're hungry. Did they choose this comp? Because not all the freshman comp courses teach these classes.
Correct.
Right. How many courses do you run per semester?
There's about 35 to 40 sections of each course each semester, and I'd say about 30% are
so about 12 to 15, which is, you
know,
it's a lot. It's a lot.
That's actually a pretty big program.
Yeah. And again, as we were discussing before, we don't want to really impose the curriculum on our faculty. We want faculty buy-in. They can make little changes as they see fit. That's an important element to it. Right. But, and also we don't really give them a certificate if they've done both. And so that's tough because on the one hand, we want to kind of have recognition and we want to have a coherence to it. On the other hand, if we push that too far, then we do have to start answering political questions about, is this a Great Books program, you know, and so on. So we've kind of, I think flying under the radar has helped us a little bit. You know, the administration and the provost and the president are very supportive of us. But on the other hand, we want to kind of keep it a well-kept secret, sort of. Not really.
I actually think that the resistance to these kinds of courses was maybe a little exaggerated by a few incidents of blockage, because if you do it right, if you do it diplomatically, if you offer this as just an alternative right. to something, it's just one part of the bigger menu, that it's very hard for administrators and fellow faculty to resist doing, wait, you don't want us to teach Dante? You don't want us to teach Shakespeare? They can't say that.
Yeah. And it's also, again, the fact that it's a writing course helps a little bit. The fact that, look, it's, you know, we don't, at the end, we don't have an exam saying, you know, do you know all about the natural law from John Locke to whoever? No, it's, you know, can you write a coherent paragraph such that, you know, you can display the skills of reading and writing and communication skills, which all employers want and all humans want and all of your relatives want of you, you know?
And that's where these texts lend themselves to interesting and engaging opportunities for reading and writing. You know, all of the activities and the assignments that we develop together to teach these texts really get students at the course objectives of composition classes. You know, how do you read something carefully analytically? How do you quote it? How do you respond to it? How do you incorporate it to make an argument or a comparison, whatever it is you're doing? All of our students, no matter what section they're in, take a departmental final exam. And it was fun for all of us last term that our students are reading these, you know, they're reading Plato, they're reading Socrates, Wollstonecraft, Du Bois, Frederick Douglass all semester. And then they take the common final exam, which is usually a modern article. And so when we read the article together in class before they took the test, they were like, this is easy.
It's typical easy. Journalism. Yeah. Right.
Great response.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That is a clear demonstration
right.
of something. They've gone from
right.
point A to point B.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so we can have all of those skills, and just what you're saying about the reading, we can work on all of those skills, the reading and writing skills, which are the SLOs, the student learning outcomes. We can do that with test prep books. We can do that with New York Times yesterday's, you know, editorial page. We can do that, but just doing this with these texts just taps them into a deeper, not merely cultural literacy, but a kind of human literacy. It just, it taps into that.
Now, if you're running 12 to 15 courses a semester, you must have a lot of faculty on board.
About 10 at any given time. And it's hard to, you know, they were wonderfully enthusiastic at the beginning. We gave them stipends. As chair and deputy chair, we've been so ridiculously busy, we've fallen back on the coffee. We need to give them more coffee. But we're getting buy-in. People are, also, we tap adjuncts, also part-timers. They love... You know, adjuncts have such tough lives as it is. They love the support we give them. Mm-hmm. The faculty are, especially the younger faculty, you know, as you know, the job market is so ridiculously flooded. We just have people coming in, and the faculty we've hired, comparative literature, Harvard, all of these people
right.
have read so many of these, so they already have the cultural background, and they're eager to teach.
It's what keeps people going when the job market is tough. You know, they came into it because this is what they love.
They love, right?
And this can they can pass it on.
Yeah.
And I think our program does a good job of creating a community for faculty. You know, because so often we don't have a chance to talk to each other about what we're teaching in our classes or what assignment we gave out that day. So. I think the faculty like having the opportunity to come together to listen to a lecture, to then talk to each other about what we're doing in our classes. So it creates a community among ourselves, as well as among students who are reading the books at the same time on campus.
So a lot of the classes have much of the same syllabi, mm-hmm. same syllabus, and so students in different classes, they're doing the same, much of the same thing. Does it build a fellowship among them?
Yeah, that's hard because the community, you know, this is not a four-year residential liberal arts school, and so, and our students, you know, they're have interesting lives, that have a lot of variables, and so family issues, homeless issues, so a lot. So I would say as much as possible it builds a community. We could do a little bit more with sort of off-campus trips and stuff, but then you're running into community college faculty who are just overworked, you know, and so I think those are the, I don't know how much further we can build that community.
Once a week, pizza night.
Well, right. I mean, that's...
Everyone can come and but you have to talk about the books.
Yes, yeah.
That's it.
I was a student, absolutely.
For free food.
No, absolutely.
Why did you get into this? Andrew, why did you get into this?
Well, I think, it grew out of...
When did this start? When did the program start? When did you get in? Did you found the program?
We did. Mm-hmm. It grew out of the work we initially did on our NEH project back, was it 2009?
2009, 2010.
That you had actually come to our campus for. We were really starting to rethink the role of the humanities in general education. I think for many of the reasons we're talking about, that we realize that students need an opportunity to read and write about things that are meaningful. You know, and to give some kind of coherence to an educational experience. And I think out of that grant, we realized some of the challenges of major curricular change.
Right. We also met Roosevelt in there. I think he was probably newly appointed as core director, and so he was one of our guest speakers. And so we would just have coffee occasionally with Roosevelt. And when was it? We tried for another NEH grant. It was not funded, but then we somehow got hooked up with the APGAR around mm-hmm. 2014.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. They were just very receptive to our ideas. They're a small family firm, a foundation dedicated to core curriculum in the Western tradition. And so they've been very generous for 3 years.
Well, I noticed that, Andrea, you're a graduate center CUNY PhD. Mm-hmm. You did your work on 17th century female religious writers?
I did, yes.
You were immersed in that. Can you bring any of that? Does that come up in the teaching, or does the inspiration of that graduate work carry over somehow?
Well, I think the graduate work that I did and that I'm continued to be interested in about prophetic women writers was also again about this sort of challenge, right? A challenge to the status quo, to rethinking a person's role in society, and that's something that I think is really important for our students, is to think about the world you're in and what factors are affecting you in that world that you might not really be aware of, right? And how empowering it is to say, oh wait, these things around me are having an influence on me. Maybe I don't want them to have an influence on me. Maybe I want to have influence back, right? And that's something that all the women in my dissertation kind of did. So that's the theme that I think is in the curriculum that we have, are these themes about self-knowledge and the factors of society that affect you. Freedom, right? What affects your freedom? How do you gain access to freedom? What prevents you from being fully free? Mm-hmm. And to have students think about that, I think, is that empowering moment.
You know, one of the people you teach, Frederick Douglass, mm-hmm. the empowering moment for him was learning to read.
Yes.
Right? Reading and reading, there are a few books that he read, like The Speeches of Richard Brinsley Sheridan, that opened up the world, right? He said, I wasn't aware. I didn't understand what was happening to me. And the reading, these old books,
of course,
from another place, another time, gave me,
of course,
my understanding of, I'm in the world.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I'm like this, and the world is like that. And that... It's certainly something that is the irrationale right there for this program.
just what you said about it's about reading just more broadly, just reading historical circumstance, reading, you know, reading a room as you walk into it, that kind of, that slow reading you were talking about earlier, Mark. I think that's one of the skills. So we understand it is a composition class about reading and writing, but it's reading in that deeper sense of, and so, you know, I always joke that I find Martin Luther King's Letter to Birmingham Jail an unteachable text because it's got so many references to the great tradition. I mean, from Socrates to Gandhi to that it's I'm not a good enough reader to read this text.
And then to read things taking the person in their moment, I think that's challenging for us with Mary Wollstonecraft when we teach a vindication of the rights of women, because for our modern perspective, it's not revolutionary at all, right? So to help to give students the opportunity to read that and really think about what that meant for her in that moment in time, that she was really revolutionary, right? And to appreciate what she's doing, to read carefully what she's saying and what makes it revolutionary. So then see how it builds again into the progress of.
So it lifts them out of that presentism, that kind mm-hmm. of like, you know, I'm only just here, I'm only just doing my 140 characters, I'm only doing the Facebook, and so it gives them a kind of depth. And so.
Your graduate work, Gregory, was in?
Wallace Stevens and Henry James, kind of modern, kind of contrasting modernism and late romanticism. I didn't really go too far anywhere. There's no book burning in my heart, but my college education was out of one of those small colleges that sprang up in the 1970s. This one was Thomas More Institute. There are other ones were, you know, like St. John's Annapolis, Cardinal Newman out in St. Louis, Magdalen in New Hampshire. A lot of them sprung up and they weren't formal great books, but I was a horrible high school student, and the first, you know, they just threw Peloponnesian War at me, and I was just, okay, all right. And so it was really my first experience with that kind of in-depth reading of a whole book, of a whole text, and discussing it.
You must have appreciated it.
Oh, absolutely. No, of course. It was life-changing. Yeah. I've been trying to get away from it, and I can't.
You know, when I went out to Monterey Peninsula, a few of the students said, I actually did this similar thing out at the University of Oklahoma, where they're doing a big course modeled on what W.H. Auden did at University of Michigan.
Oh, yeah.
Which was this daunting Western civilization course. He had them reading 6,000 pages.
That's right. I remember.
Mostly poetry. But the students I talked to said, this is really hard. But their attitude was, one, I feel like I'm involved in something significant.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm not reading contemporary novels. I'm doing something that isn't really ordinary. Right. I'm doing something extraordinary here, and it's a challenge. And my teachers respect me enough to present this to me and say, you can do this.
Right.
Also, there was the sense of, I'm climbing the highest hill here. The other courses have easier, more accessible readings. I'm in a tougher boot camp.
Yeah.
And there's a self-respect, I think, that follows.
Yes.
From that, and that's where the greatness factor comes in that I highlighted first things, is they want to feel like I'm making contact with something momentous, right? Mary Wollstonecraft, this was a big moment. This was a historic occasion, her writing that book, and we're 220 years past it, and we're still reading it,
right.
And I'm reading it.
Right.
I'm making contact with greatness
right
here. And I think that lifts them up.
Absolutely, absolutely.
What happens in this room is different from what happened. That's what's supposed to happen when you go into church, right? I'm going out of the world into it. And so I tell students, open your books, come in here, and now the universe doesn't extend past these pages.
Yeah.
This is all, we are absorbed in this little cloister for an hour and 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And letting them know there's another thing to do than talk on the phone, all the materials of present social life that just flood them all the time. I imagine that they're going to remember this course. They're going to remember this reading.
Also resonant, especially for our students, so many of them, their exposure to actual texts is very limited. You know, I'm guessing that a lot of people had, you know, parents who read them stories when they were falling asleep. I can't guarantee that these students have had that experience to that basic form of literacy. I'm not sure a lot of them have even owned a book ever or read a book cover to cover. Students ask, what's an index? What's a table of contents? And you have to show them. And so, and it's wonderful, and they get it. They're bright, brilliant kids, and they're wonderful students. But this is a different world to them.
Well, it just that just proves how much it's needed.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
That just demonstrates you're doing something very good for these kids, and it's going to last them for a long, long time. I tell students when they come, what courses should I take? So first thing you say, what courses can I take that are going to help me when I'm 30? Not right now.
Right.
You're 21.
Right.
What course is going to be good for you to take when to have taken when you're 30 years old?
That's right. Right, when you're a decision maker, when you have power, when you, you know, have the power to hurt and will do none, you know? So, you know, that's when you're, that's when these courses and these moments, we hope, will inspire you.
Now, just the idea of taking time with things, or this, we're in this world, nothing else matters right now, right? That for a writing class in particular, I think students often come to writing classes very nervous about it because there's not a really an understanding of how the writing process works.
Right.
I think it's like either a talent that you have or a talent you don't have, right? Either I can write or I can't, and I don't think I can. So, you know, I'm not gonna dwell in this class.
All of you can become competent writers. Few of them can become brilliant writers. Few of us in the world, all of us can become competent writers in this room.
But it takes time.
It takes time.
And your first draft is not gonna be perfect. You're going to have to go back and work on it some more and add to it. And just like you're reading, you're not going to read The Trial and Death of Socrates the first time and just get it. You know, you have to go back. You have to look at it again. So there's a recursive thinking that we really try to engage students in a writing class in general, but more particularly in this class because of the nature of mm-hmm. the texts.
You know, it would be interesting, I don't know if you do this, to see where these students who were in the classes 5, 6 years ago.
Right. I mean, yeah, I mean, longitudinal studies are always out there. I know.
No. Anyway, that was great. Thank you. Thank you for the work that you do out there at Hostas. And why don't we have you back in a year and you can fill us in on how things are progressing.
Brilliant. Love
Thank
to.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us. Wonderful.
Thank you.